Accession number 11261. Real one.
That's right, yes.
Real one. And if I could ask you, first of all, about your life before the war, you know, what part of Yugoslavia would you have been brought and raised in?
Well, as you can see here on the map, you see, there's the map of Yugoslavia, and there's Serbia here, am I right?
Yes.
And just have a look. And here is the Bulgaria... the Bulgarian frontier, so I was very near that eastern frontier between Yugoslavia and Bulgaria, only about 50 or 60 miles, so it was very peripheral, right out in the country. There were very few sort of smallish towns about, and the nearest two were, well, something like about 15 miles from my village, one to the north, one to the west. It was primitive life, and it was, well, difficult life. In those days, we had no electricity. We had very little. There was hardly any transport between, you know, the adjoining towns. So you had to make your own plans and provide transport as you needed it.
How about your education?
Well, even then, at that time, the first 3 years, I had to go to the neighboring village where our school was. It was catering for several surrounding villages. And as you may know, on the continent, the school age starts later, and of course, in my time, we started, you know, after, you know, when you completed 7 years of age, and then for the last year, the fourth year, they opened a school in my village, so I was then able to finish my sort of primary education there. And then moved on to the secondary school or gymnasium. You probably know. I mean, it's the same word as gymnasium, but it is more like the German type Hochschule, lasting for 4 years before you take the lower sort of school certificate, and then going for another 4 years until you take the sort of the exam of maturity, which qualifies you to go to the university. I did 4 years there. That was the place was called Knyazevac, which is quite a sort of sizable provincial town now. And then I went to Prizren, which is part within the troubled province of Kosovo now, called Kosovo and Metohija. To a theological college, where I was for 5 years, from 36 to 41. Then, of course, the war broke out, or shall we say, we were invaded and occupied by the Germans.
Yes, if I could sort of stop you there at that point, because this, of course, would have been, 1941...
That's right.
1941, yes.
April, yes.
When the war broke out in Europe, you know, in 1939, did that affect your area of Yugoslavia at all, or your particular situation? It must have been very destabilising for you, you know, to know that war was ongoing.
Well, as far as I'm aware, it was destabilising for everybody, and it was worrying, and... obviously, the German menace was rising daily, not weekly or monthly, but daily. They were threatening everybody, invading. I mean, countries were falling down like pins. we were on the periphery, as you can imagine. So we were not their primary objective at that time, but the menace was there. And there was the Finnish-Soviet war. There were the trouble with the Baltic states, the troubles with Poland, partitions, and so on. We didn't rest comfortably. Our politicians were equally confused, probably even more so. Some of them were trying to come to some agreement with the Axis powers. The pressure was terrific. As you know, our king was assassinated in 1934 in Marseille, so he had regency government at that time. The politicians were not particularly reliable. They were shifty, they were often quibbling about, you know, irrelevancies. And there was a great deal of gerrymandering and elections rigged and intimidation. I mean, for example, the particular group to which I belonged as a student was persecuted. The leader and most known members were in special camps, detained as sort of enemies of the state.
What group would that have been called?
It was Zbor.
Zbor,
which was founded in the 30s by the so much maligned Ljotić, Dmitri Ljotić. Have you heard of him? You have. One of the nicest and the finest politicians I heard, probably the only honest politician we had. Before the war, he was minister, I think minister of justice for some time. He was a deeply religious person. He was devout. He was a great patriot. But at the same time, he was writing in his bulletin, which was sort of fairly regular publication, in which he was warring against the different types of internationals, against the clerical international from the Vatican, the Red International from Moscow, and of course the fascist international. He was predicting what would happen. But the politicians didn't like this because he was pointing out also what should be done to save Yugoslavia from this rapid disintegration. But of course that wasn't very popular with those who were in power. And some of them, in fact, Sturdinovic, one of our absolute, not immediate, but almost immediate, last but one prime minister of Yugoslavia. He was very much inclined to... he was very much in favor of Hitler's ideas, and he started introducing, in a way, modified sort of black shirts and the kind of guard that he was, you know, having in mind was along those lines. Then he was replaced by Cvetković, who was a very weak politician in many ways, didn't have much respect in the country. He came from my part of the country, Nish, and during his time, this was in the 1941, he was pressurized to come to some understanding with the Axis powers, because by that time, most of Europe was under their feet. England was one of the few surviving. I think everybody else was down at that time. So we were surrounded. The Bulgarians were their allies. The Romanians were also, well, there was a coup, and so the fascist, or the Iron Guard took over, and of course they were very much you know, in line with Hitler's thinking. So it was a kind of fascist organization. Greece was in trouble then because there was a war between Albania and Greece and the Italian invasion. All that was there. And there was a pressure very much on Prince Paul, again, very, very much maligned. He was the, you know, one of the three regents, and well, I presume the most influential one, being the uncle to our young king. Then I mean, he was still a minor, and you probably know Prince Paul was invited to go to Berlin once or twice. The politicians were looking at various modus vivendi from this very difficult situation. What to do, how to... There was the trouble in Yugoslavia itself, in Croatia especially, again since 1939, because of the unrest there. The Yugoslav government allowed or created the so-called Banovina Hrvatska, the province of Croatia, which had its own ban or chief. And they were given a great deal of autonomy. So if you were not a Croat, you were not allowed to have a job in Croatia. But the Croats were employed all over the country, including the very high state offices in Belgrade and elsewhere. So they had their cake all to themselves, and they were having shares from other people's cakes. Because that kind, they started persecuting the Serbian, especially Serbian population, the Orthodox population. Okay, I don't know how much you know about it, but there is this deep religious division between the Orthodox, which are predominantly almost synonymous with Serbs, and Croats, who are most of them Roman Catholics. And there was this, not, you know, the kind of division. There was the Western influence in Croatia and Slovenia. There was less of this in Serbia and Macedonia and, you know, the northern provinces of Banat. There was more Oriental influence also in Bosnia and Herzegovina and Montenegro. So there was this cultural division or divide between running across the country. There was this conflict of interest between different, the Western influences and the Eastern influences. Then there was the unfortunate relationship with Russia, which has been considered to be the Mother Russia, the great protectress of the Slavs. As you know, I mean, during the Middle Ages and the 16th and 17th, 18th and 19th century, there were a great deal of help came from Russia in various liberation wars in the Balkans. They helped the Bulgarians, they helped the Montenegrins and Serbs. And of course, there was this great devotion and deep sentiment felt towards Russia. And although Ljotić was one of those people who pointed out, well, Russia is not what we thought was Mad Russia. This is a communist dictatorship. Very few people believe this. And he was suggesting, in desperation almost, said, well, if you, to those who don't believe, to the communist hotheads, you know, I would, if I had any power, I would give them full state assistance, send them to Russia, let them spend a few weeks or a few months there, then let them come back. And if they still want to be communists, by all means, we'll give them every assistance. But he was convinced that they would come back thoroughly disillusioned, disheartened and disappointed, because they would have discovered that what he was saying and very few others was right, and what they believed through the propaganda, which was poor through the state organization, was false. But nonetheless, you see, you can't destroy those prejudices. You mentioned Lord Aldington and how many people are in favor. You see, there are these sort of, you know, deep links with particular ideas, with particular people, with particular movements, if you like, and they can't do anything wrong. Others can't do anything right.
Where does Tito and the partisans, what part of, you know, is there any particular grouping in Yugoslav that they would have come from, or would they have been people in all the different, out of all the different groups?
Tito at that time wasn't known at all. He was in Russia under a different name, and he was working there, again, getting rid of his rivals. Stalin was at the height of his power then, and you know, the 30s, and, you know, all the Chistke, you know, the what's the process? The trials in which they got rid of anybody who was
the purges.
The purges, yes, who was in the least suspected as unreliable, not being unreliable, suspected, or as a likely rival or danger at any time. I mean, after all, Stalin started by liquidating Trotsky and other rivals, and later on Bakunin and the rest of them, and we know that those trials went on and how many millions of people perished in that. Mm-hmm. And of course Tito was one of his trusted lieutenants in those days, and eventually he got rid of his, you know, one or two likely rivals for the Yugoslav section of the Comintern, and then so he became established. He was married to a Russian girl. I think he had them, you know, one or two children with her, I'm not sure. And it wasn't until after the war that he appeared, when he was sent by the Comintern to organize the Yugoslav party. And so, again, it was done.
I was thinking about the partisans, you know, and the role they played in Yugoslavia in the war. Am I right in thinking that the partisans would have been socialists, communists, you know?
Well, we are jumping there. I mean, I don't know. As I was saying, did you want me to say something about this, the political manoeuvres, first, I would say. There was just imminently a few weeks before we were invaded by the Germans, a kind of, you know, half-hearted attempt by the then government to come to some agreement with the Germans or the Axis, and in fact a particular agreement was concluded, and only yesterday I was reading about this. Which was not published in full. There were two paragraphs which were, or clauses which were to remain secret until Germany or the Axis powers agreed for them publishing, because it would have appeared, according to this, that Yugoslavia was to be the practically sole beneficiary, and the Germans would be on the losing side. But I think it was genuine, because they were offering, you know, sort of peace, integrity of the state boundaries, if Yugoslavia allowed the transit of German troops to Salonika, so that they could, you know, sort of finish off Greece. Salonika was promised to Yugoslavia as a port on the sea in that area. And as I said, the integrity of the state would have been guaranteed. But of course, you may have read only a few days ago in the Times the obituary. Yes, it was Tom Mapleback. Now, he died recently in his 95th year. Now, he was at that time the deputy military attaché, and he was here, you know, even the Times pointed out that he was in touch with the people who engineer the coup d'etat on the 27th of March. So he was behind. He promised all sorts of help. And, of course, the leading general, Mirkovich, who was the aviation minister, was in cahoots with him. And, of course, the coup was organized. There were spontaneous demonstrations everywhere. I was still in prison at that time, in college. We knew that some of the leading demonstrators were their leading communists. So we knew them because we had been having quarrels and discussions and arguments for them for several years. In fact, I had several either communists or sympathizers of the communist system in my theological college. And we had to lead this internal struggle against them. Eventually we managed to get a few of them excluded. Expelled from the college. I mean, you know, we couldn't imagine that somebody was preparing to be a priest and at the same time follow an atheist doctrine. But there were others from the students and the secondary school and the gymnasium. They were there amongst the leaders, shouting. It's better to have better war than the pact, and this was the pact that was to be about to be concluded between Yugoslavia and Germany, or the Axis. Anyway, but there was a great deal of spontaneous rejoicing. The king was, you know, supposed to have broadcast and taken over, the power. And of course, we didn't know that it was somebody else who was imitating him and misusing his title and his prestige. Only later we knew who it was.
What did you yourself think about a pact with the Germans?
It's very difficult to say because we didn't know exactly the details. We knew that we were in a very difficult situation. We knew that we would not have the slightest chance of surviving. Germany and Italy, I mean, Italy was there ready to jump at us. Croatia was very much up in arms. They were almost considering themselves to have seceded from Yugoslavia. And of course, you get Pavelić later, who comes and starts with the pogroms in Croatia. With 2 million, Serbian lost lives. The Hungarians were making threatening noises. The Bulgarians on the eastern side, we were, again, not our friends. You know, at that time we had a practical joke, and this is not more than a joke. When you ask, who was Yugoslavia surrounded by? And the answer was Brigama. And that in Serbian means with troubles. And there you are, see. There is Bulgaria, B, Romania, I, Italy, Bri, Greece, Briga, Albania, A, Hungary, M, Mađarska, Austria, Brigama. Mi smo ograničeni brigama. And that was our, I think that just about summed up our precarious predicament. So whoever was there would have had to do something about it. Now, Turkey came to some agreement with the Germans, as you know. They survived. They didn't lose practically, I don't think they lost any. Victims during the war, they didn't lose any integrity, they didn't lose their sort of nationhood, they benefited, we lost everything. We had more than 2 million massacred and killed during that war. At the end of it all, after Tom Maplebank and his colleagues had pushed us into this stupid coup, We had Tito as our reward for another 40 or 50 years slavery, which is still not crumbling down, although it's tumbling down in all other communist strongholds in Yugoslavia. They're still holding out. So you see, but you see, the most ironic thing about it is that the coup, which happened on the 27th of March, although it appeared to be anti-pact, it appeared to be, and I don't think anybody thought more about it. We just thought, right, well, here it is, we are ready to fight with our, you know, wooden staves and, you know, old-fashioned rifles and all that, and we'll just, you know, go and fight against the German tanks, and that will be it. We were enthusiastic about it. We were prepared to fight, although I don't think anybody thought for one moment that this was a hopeless sort of David Goliath struggle, much worse than that. The day after the coup, the new prime minister, Simović, sent his foreign minister to Hitler to assure him that that pact was still in force. So it wasn't really, I mean, it only a few hours later showed that the whole thing was not in any way anti-German or anti-pact, because they were prepared to say, well, here it is, we'll accept all this. But Hitler had different ideas. He said, right, the Serbs have done this now. Again, I'm a Serb. The Serbs have done this, and now we're going to teach them a lesson. And I quote one or two things where he said, you know, we've got to annihilate Yugoslavia, we want to wipe out the Serbs and all that. On the 6th of April, he did it. You know, without any declaration of war, Belgrade was bombed, the National Library and various other institutions, and thousands, 30,000, 40,000 people were, you know, killed in that air raid. And of course,
Where were you that day? Can you remember the reactions to it and what happened to you?
At that time, now, you see, I mentioned the 27th of March. I was still in prison, but we knew that this would be the, you know, well, the end of our freedom. So I'm not quite sure, but the college closed down soon after that, you know, the next day or two, I'm not sure. And excuse me, just... It's ridiculous. Affected about this, there it is. It is something you just can't control. Anyway, as I was saying, we didn't... I don't remember how soon the college closed, but I remember one thing, that I was one of those who managed to catch the last train from Uroševac to Skopje, and then from there to Niš and home. And of course, I must have been home then before the bombardment of Belgrade and the beginning of the invasion. Yes, it must have been, because when I came home, there was a state of chaos. There was a kind of so-called mobilization taking place. People were called up to report to their units. There didn't seem to be much order or much system, you know, what was being done or how it was being done. But I felt at this time that, well, I had to go and do something myself. So I went, I don't remember who else with me, I think there was somebody else. We went to report as volunteers. But soon we realized that we were chasing, an impossible dream, because by this time the army was beginning to disintegrate. There were people throwing their arms, going home, changing to civilian clothes. because the German power obviously has overwhelmed them. You know, I mean, if some people fought with bare hands, jumping on German tanks. But, so anyway, we inquired where to report, where would be the base of our unit. No one could give us any information. So, eventually came home. And of course the war was over in very few days. I mean, I think it took some like a fortnight before the capitulation was signed. Tom Maplebank flew. He pushed the people into this disaster, and he was one of the first to escape. He even forgot to take 10 cases of ammunition, of explosives that he has brought for sabotage work, which was dumped into the swimming pool of the house where he was living, and later on when the Germans came there, they discovered that. So that was the kind of help we had from our so-called friend.